We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the story of a small group of soldiers deployed in Iraq in 2005. They were sent to the country's most dangerous area at its most dangerous time. They experienced heavy losses and a chronic breakdown in leadership. They would go on to commit one of the worst war crimes of the Iraq War. Our guest for this hour is Jim Frederick. He is a contributing editor at Time magazine. He's written about this story in a newly published book. The title is Black Hearts, One Platoon's Descent into Madness in Iraq's Triangle of Death. Harmony Books is the publisher. If you're interested in reading it, it's just out. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Our guest, Jim Frederick, worked for Time. He was a senior editor in London, and before that, he was the magazine's Tokyo bureau chief. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, as always, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people is that they try to keep their comments brief so we can get as many callers in as possible. But certainly anybody who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And you may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, certainly people who are listening can participate in the program. Mr. Frederick, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm honored.
I think that maybe a good way to start out would be for me to ask you to explain, as you do in the book, how it is you got into the story. And it was because of two different stories that you heard about when you were working for Time and you were in Tokyo. And the first one concerns some soldiers, three soldiers. They were taken hostage by insurgents. They were tortured and killed. Tell us a little bit more of that first story.
Right. I was working in Tokyo as Time magazine's Tokyo bureau chief, and there were other people at Time magazine who were covering the Iraq War, and so while I was doing my job covering Japanese economics and politics, I was following the Iraq War just like one would as an average news reader. I would read the papers and the internet sites every morning, and I was fairly captivated, as in the way that the world was at that time. Mid-June 2006, three troopers from the 101st Airborne Division got overrun at a remote checkpoint about 20 miles south of Baghdad. One was killed on the scene, two were taken hostage, and it precipitated the largest manhunt in the history of the war up until that time. There were about 8,000 soldiers that were mustered because, when a U.S. soldier gets taken hostage, it's a very big deal. And I followed this story for two or three days, captivated as many were. The two missing soldiers were found, in fact, beheaded, mutilated, booby-trapped with IEDs or explosive devices about 72 hours after they were taken. In the aftermath, it does appear that they were, in fact, killed fairly quickly. They weren't actually kept alive for that whole 72 hours, but it made a lasting impression on me. And about 2 weeks, 3 weeks after that, there was another worldwide headlining-generating story that four soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division had just been arrested or detained or under suspicion for raping a 14-year-old Iraqi girl and killing her, her two parents, and her six-year-old sister. Mm-hmm. And obviously this seemed to me an absolutely horrific crime, and an incredibly disappointing would be an understatement in, you know, American forces would do such a thing. And as the news started trickling, the picture became clearer. It became clearer and clearer that these four soldiers were not just from the same 101st Airborne Division. They were from the same brigade. They were from the same battalion, which is about 700 men. They were from the same company, Bravo Company, which is 135 men. And then the thing that really hit me across the face was they weren't just from the same company. They were from the same platoon, 1st Platoon, which is about 35 to 40 men. So 7 men were involved in 2 of the most notorious events of the war up to that period. And they were all from the same group of 35 men in the same platoon. And that made me think to myself, what could possibly have been going on in that platoon? Now, whether it was fate or chance or whatever you want to call it, around this several week or several month period, I got a call from an Army captain stationed in Baghdad, whom I had known through my job. He was an Army lawyer, a defense lawyer, and he called me up as I was thinking about these things or just sort of marveling at this story. And he had been assigned to defend one of the 4 who were accused of this rape and murder. And he called me because he quite honestly didn't know very many journalists. And he said, I'm just calling you because I have been down to this place where this company and this platoon is headquartered, and I can't believe the way that they are living, the fight that they are fighting, how bloody it is, how undermanned, how understaffed. They don't even have the basic equipment that you would expect an American fighting man to have. It is an absolute scandal what's going on with this company. And he said quite plainly, he said, I want you, please investigate what's happening with that company and that platoon, not for the sake of my client, but for the sake of the rest of the men in Bravo Company, because what's going on down there is a scandal. It is... they are have been completely abandoned down there, and I think that you should investigate it. And because I respected this captain and because the story had already captured my interest, I did just that. I followed the news even more closely. This unit rotated back to the States that fall. I started calling some of the men from 1st Platoon, seeing if they wanted to talk. The 4 who were accused of the rape and murder, their court trials, you know, they went to courts martial and they wended through the court system over the next several years. And every 1st Platoon trooper that I talked to was wary at first, but I gained their trust and they passed along names to other men I should talk to. And it just sort of ballooned and ballooned and ballooned. But that's how I got involved and interested in the story.
Well, and did from the beginning, did you think that the conditions under which these men there were living and the deaths of these 3 soldiers, that those things were connected in important ways to this vicious, very disturbing crime?
Well, there was always, well, were the two connected? In all the, of course, at first there was a suspicion, you know, was it a revenge crime? Was it retaliation? Did insurgents know that the 4 men had committed this crime, so they retaliated on this platoon in order to, you know, as a revenge, as an avenging the murder of Abir al-Janabi and the rape of her and the murder of her family? I'll give you the end point first, which is none of my research has demonstrated that there was any connection whatsoever, that it was a complete coincidence, in fact, that these 4 men committed this crime and then 3 men from the platoon were taken hostage. There is no connection. Now, you will meet a lot of people who are convinced there was a connection because once the crime that Americans committed the crime came out in public, al-Qaeda and various insurgent groups capitalized on the propaganda value of the fact that they had just overrun this checkpoint. And so they released a bunch of videos saying, oh, it was definitely us, and it was definitely revenge, and that was the reason that we did it. But if you look very closely at the timing of when the checkpoint was overrun and the insurgent videos and claims about the overrunning of the checkpoint until the U.S. Army came forward and said that American troopers had committed the rape and murder, they never mentioned it, not once. So that is circumstantial evidence, yes, but it's pretty convincing circumstantial evidence that insurgents would not capitalize on the propaganda value of American soldiers committing a heinous war crime until after Americans admitted and confessed that they did it. They only capitalized on it afterwards. That indicates to me that, in fact, the insurgents themselves didn't know.
Something else, and I imagine that some people might react to this book and this story Certainly, initially, their reaction is going to be just how disturbing and upsetting it is to read about what it is that happened. And then they might say something like, well, writing an entire book about this, it's bad for morale, it's bad for the image of the United States, and the men were justly punished, and they would raise questions about why it is this is an important story to tell. Now, having said all that, what really strikes me is that the men, that you, the soldiers that you had the opportunity to talk with about this, while maybe initially reluctant, they were just as appalled, maybe even more disgusted with the men who did this than you or I. So it seems that within the military, there actually was a strong sense that this was a story that should be investigated, that should be told, that the people responsible should be punished for it, and that they seem to be interested in shedding light on it and not covering it up.
Absolutely. Well, the first sentiment that you described, that, you know, why are you airing dirty laundry? Why are you bringing discredit and shame upon the United States military? Those sorts of reactions, I think I've maybe gotten two, maybe three letters along those lines, and it's entirely unclear whether or not those people have any connection to the military or any intimate knowledge of the Army at all, because I have been surprised and gratified that the closer that you get to these events and the men involved in those events and the overarching Army leadership structure, the degree to which the book has in fact been embraced and has been pushed forward as a teaching and learning tool and a case study about leadership and the crucible of warfare and how systems break down and how the Army can learn from systems breaking down and making sure that it doesn't happen again, has been absolutely overwhelming. I very quickly, as I was researching the book, it started out as a true crime book, but I became much more interested in the other men of 1st Platoon and the other platoons in Bravo Company who went through the exact same deprivations, the exact same loss, the exact same suffering that the four men who committed this crime did, but they managed to maintain their integrity, their dignity, their combat readiness. They came through with their honor intact. I mean, it was a very difficult deployment, but everybody went through those same deprivations. And so those soldiers became more interesting to me almost than the criminals. So the book it started out as a true crime book, and it became a study of leadership, character, morality under the extreme stress of combat. And I've been very, very gratified, beyond my wildest dreams, in fact, the degree to which the United States Army has embraced the book as exactly that. I get a lot of letters, not just from the men in Bravo Company, but from colonels and instructors at West Point and captains who are at, Command and General Staff College, who say that people are passing the book around because it has so many lessons, because it's almost like a case study of leadership. So in a couple weeks into the book being released, I'm more confident than ever that if anybody brings to me those sort of criticisms that the book is somehow anti-Army or anti-American, I would say, well, talk to the United States Army itself, because it doesn't seem to me that anybody in the United States Army thinks that it's an anti-Army or an anti-American book. The Army is very interested in having everybody read it.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Jim Frederick. He's contributing editor at Time magazine. He's also been Time's senior editor in London and the magazine's Tokyo bureau chief. The book that we're talking about is out now. The title is Black Hearts, and it is published by Harmony Books. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think also to help people to understand how this happened, how this could happen, you also have to talk a little bit about, at this particular time, what was going on in this place, and then also maybe what the strategy on the ground in Iraq was at that time, because that's all tangled up together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a big part of the reason that this unit had so much trouble is because they were in country at exactly the most chaotic moment, meaning in a large part, Black Hearts is a study in the tactical consequences of a failed strategy. there's a lot of talk and there's been a lot of books about, well, we don't have enough boots on the ground, or, you know, Rumsfeld and the Bush administration, they thought that we could always do more with less. And we should have gone in there with 500,000 soldiers, and we only went in there with 150,000 soldiers. And Blackhearts is an examination of what does that mean when you don't have enough boots on the ground? What does that mean for the end-of-the-line soldiers? And what that means is, by Army doctrine, the Army doesn't really like to maneuver in anything less than a squad, which is about 10 or 11 men. If it can help it, it doesn't want to go anywhere with less than a platoon, which is about 35 or 40 men. The men of Bravo Company, and especially 1st Platoon, they were going on patrols with 3 or 4 or 5 men. They were manning checkpoints where there would only be one NCO, which is a sergeant or more senior. And so when they were, say, 6 men at a checkpoint and they got called out to do a patrol, that then the sergeant would have to split up the checkpoint. There would only be one NCO, and the whole group would split it. So you'd have 3 junior soldiers going out into a patrol, and mind you, this is the most dangerous place in Iraq at its most dangerous moment, arguably, going out and doing three-man patrols. And that is appalling. I mean, that is appalling troop management. It is a failure of the Army, and it is a failure of the United States that we would ask our soldiers to do that. So in my research, I was actually, as a taxpayer and as a citizen, I've never served in the military, I was stunned and appalled that it was okay that we ask our soldiers to do this. And those were the kind of conditions that 1st Platoon and Bravo Company were operating under. Now, to move it one step further, the second part of your question, beyond the fact that they were undermanned to a point where they were doing really dangerous and risky stuff, the theory, the strategy, the practice of what we were there for was not clear at all. This was the rotation and the deployment before counterinsurgency theory and tactic really took hold, before, you know, the Petraeus model of embracing the population, keeping the population safe. It seems so obvious in retrospect, but to be fair to this unit and to be, you know, fair, I guess, to the Army at large, there was no unified strategy being pushed down from the Pentagon all the way through the chain of command. So the men on the ground were getting very conflicting signals about what is the first priority. Is the first priority to hunt down and kill bad guys? Well, when you do that too aggressively, you tend to kill some innocent people and then you create more insurgents. Or was the priority to embrace the population, you know, protect the population, make sure that the population is safe at all costs, which is also a risky proposition because by doing that, you have to take your guard down and that you're opening yourself, in order to protect the population more completely, you're actually opening yourself up, the Army up, to even more casualties because you're, you know, you have to live among the population. You have to prove to the good locals that you're not going to hurt them. And by doing that, let's say you have to take down your, you know, your weapon, and then you're opening yourself up to, if that person is actually an insurgent, they are going to kill you. So that was a very, they were getting conflicting messages all over the chain of command. So they didn't, there's no question that they were at tension. If you ask even all the way down to the squad level, the specialists who were deployed at that time, they will tell you conflicting things about what the greater and overarching mission was. Now, deployments 2 or 3 times after that, it was very clear. You know, the Petraeus Doctrine had taken sway, and it was a very unified order handing down that protecting the population is the first priority. It is such a priority that you need to put yourself, the soldier, at more risk than you otherwise would in order to make sure that the civilians are not harmed in any way. Well, that's crystal clear once it's articulated, but it wasn't being articulated to these men, and so very often they were intensely focused on hunting and killing bad guys. And I don't think necessarily because they executed that strategy and that philosophy, an unavoidable byproduct of that is that you tend to kill some innocent people too, and then you start the cycle of insurgency anew. Yeah.
We have a caller here, one to bring into the conversation. Others are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Morning. I have 2 questions and 1 critique. To begin with a question, you can answer it later if you want to. Somebody mentioned that, or made the observation that there are 2 sets of people in America – people to believe that the soldiers, our soldiers, are heroes, and another set to believe they're victims. And I wonder if you could take your take on that. The second, the critique is, I can see why the Army likes this book. I mean, this thing's spinning like a top, to my mind. I mean, we fought the Vietnamese War, so they should have learned all the lessons then, you'd think, wouldn't you? Going on from there, I wonder, my next question is, since we found out later that atrocities and murder and trigger-happy protection of yourself and terror on our part, being scared, our troops, that is said, was a big part of that war, and that's why we were shooting so many people, and that's why we're shooting so many people in Iraq now, my final, I don't know, why would you leave it that much to talk about that? Thanks.
All right.
Okay. Well, I reject the notion that all soldiers are heroes, and I reject the notion that all soldiers are victims. I think that all soldiers are human beings. And I tried to present the men of 1st Platoon and Bravo Company and the rest of the 1st to the 502nd as men who have and it is all men. This particular company is exclusively men, so a lot of times you have to say servicemen and servicewomen, but you know, the men of Bravo Company were all men, to present them as human beings who voluntarily and knowingly took a dangerous job for a wide variety of reasons, and tried to perform the job almost without exception to the best of their ability. Many of them did very heroic things. Some of them, you know, compromised their integrity and allowed combat, the extreme stresses of combat, to break them down psychologically to the point where they did things that they would never have done in a civilian setting. And so I think we do our soldiers a disservice, and we do America a disservice when we feel the need to categorize soldiers in terms of two camps, where they're either heroes or they're victims. In fact, they're human beings trying to do a very difficult and dangerous job, sometimes when the strategy is not only not clear but misguided, but they don't really have a choice, and they do their job to the best of their ability. I have to be completely honest, I don't really understand what the critique was. I would be happy to address the critique, but I don't know what saying that the book was spinning like a top actually means.
This is the critique. The critique goes like this. What you're saying, you're trying to say that these people are human beings under extreme stress, and therefore they do things that they shouldn't do. And I'll grant that that happens. Of course, you also say that as a moral choice, they chose to go there. It's a volunteer army. Now, they might have chose for what reasons they thought were legitimate, but still, perhaps they're being manipulated, i.e. Iraq, for instance, the reasons for going to war, et cetera. I don't say it's a simple thing to parse out. And of course, I don't say they're all heroes, they're all victims. Well, I guess my second question might be, in Vietnam, we wound up fighting, and books have been written saying that our troops over there did become, due to one thing or another, rather out of control. Tremendous amounts of civilian casualties. Do you think the same thing's happening in Iraq? We'll find out later.
No, I don't think that the same thing is happening in Iraq, and I don't think that the book says that, you know, men are placed under this extreme stress, therefore they commit these acts. I mean, I think that the bulk of the book is actually trying to examine why some men break down and some men don't. And the book in no way alleviates the four men who committed this crime of the personal responsibility that is theirs and theirs alone. Because if you look at the rest of the platoon and the rest of the company and the rest of the battalion, they endured the exact same combat stress that the four men who committed the crime did, and they didn't do those things. And so the book is an examination of, well, why is that? Why do some men falter and some men don't? And I'm not sure that's really an answerable question. I mean, it's a question as old as warfare itself, but I did my level best to try to put the crime in context to see what some of the factors might have been contributing to the stress of the overall platoon.
Well, let me just take that further, and then we have another caller. Let me take that further, because I'm sure that some people would think that for these men to have been capable of doing this, something clearly was wrong with them. Their moral compasses were not functioning. And then one might ask the question, well, were the conditions that made that possible, was that combat stress? Was it something that happened to them while they were there? or was there something about these men that something in their physical, mental, psychological, moral makeup that they brought with them that made it possible for this to happen?
Yeah, I think at least for two of the four men who committed this crime, pre-deployment, if not pre-army, two of the four men had demonstrated obvious psychopathic and sociopathic tendencies. Stephen Green was well known, even before he joined the Army, to be a white supremacist, a misanthrope. He joined the Army, he said, in great part, sometimes just to kill people. James Barker had a history of spousal abuse and certain behavioral problems that certainly should have sent a red flag to the Army establishment that this man probably was not mission capable or should be watched very closely before he's sent into combat. So that being said, I think it's a fact that men, and again, we're talking about men because this company, men are endowed in any setting with natural capabilities and abilities to overcome stress, to cope with adversarial setbacks. Everybody starts from a different starting line, as it were, and it's true in the civilian world. People are able to cope with stress or not cope with stress to varying degrees of ability. It's very clear that these four men, especially two of them, did not start from a starting line that most men start from. And so under the extreme stress of combat, it stands obvious in retrospect that they were among those who were prime candidates to unravel. So I think it's a combination of all of those factors, is that some men are either naturally endowed or endowed through their upbringing and their socioeconomic and their all of their education and the complete package of what it means to be a human being are capable of withstanding these kinds of extreme stresses that we call upon our soldiers to withstand. And there are some who probably shouldn't be in the Army in the first place. And there's at least one, probably two, if not all four of the men who committed this crime shouldn't have been in the Army in the first place. And so that is an Army failure. I mean, it is incumbent upon the Army to weed these people out. I mean, that's part of what any organization does. You don't want psychopaths in your midst. But I do think that when you put, if they slipped through the cracks then, as it were, and they were put in this extremely hostile and extremely stressful environment, it does, to a certain degree, stand to reason that they are going to become the first to unravel. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Jim Frederick. He's a contributing editor at Time magazine, has worked for Time in London, been the senior editor in London. He was also the magazine's Tokyo bureau chief. He's the author of the new book, Black Hearts, One Platoon's Descent into Madness in Iraq's Triangle of Death. It's published by Harmony Books, just out now. Questions welcome. We have somebody here standing by ready to go. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. The next caller is in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I began listening a little bit late, so I hope I'm not missing anything. But the last thing said were pretty much correct. Because of the military is missing lots of bodies, they're getting almost everybody. But again, the main question is, what those kids, women, men are doing in foreign soil, killing people and dying for what? That's the main question. And it seems that the mainstream media and the manipulated media never ask those questions. What we have achieved in Korea, in Vietnam, 57,000 American soldiers died and 2-3 million Vietnamese got killed. And what was the achievement? The big corporations are enslaving cheap labor right now. They are the same things with pipelines in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's the question. Of course, putting in an extreme situation, everybody wants to do either their job or defend themselves. And our constitution said that our military has to be in the borders guarding America, not being in 170 countries 750 military bases around the world protecting big money and big corporations. So that to me is the main question it has to be asked. And unfortunately, war is a racket, and the casualties are usually ordinary soldiers, ordinary people. And unfortunately, the last several wars, more and more casualties in civilians. That's the worst thing. That's the ugly thing.
Yeah, the caller has posed a number of broad questions. I don't know, Mr. Frederick, can you address some of them?
Probably not, only because I actually think that there are any number of books, media, publications. I mean, I think that there are libraries filled that examine exactly those questions and the geopolitical ramifications of the Korean War and the Vietnam War and even, in fact, the Iraq War. I think that there's tremendous bodies of literature asking exactly those questions. And I'm not trying to duck the question, but I am trying to focus specifically. Blackheart's purposely avoided any kind of political discussion about whether or not the Iraq War made any sense whatsoever, because there's literally hundreds of books that have already been written about exactly that question. And this book, purposely and specifically, was about a small group of soldiers for whom, rightly or wrongly, the politics of the Iraq War mattered to them not a whit. They were soldiers doing their job, and they go where the commander-in-chief orders them to go. So they might be vehemently opposed to it, or they might be 100% behind the war effort. It's not their choice to make. They get thrown into the war zone whether they like it or not, and then they have to cope with what is precisely and exactly their job, which is to fight for their country, or if the orders are to try to rebuild a country, or if the orders are to try to protect the population, that's what they do. And for that reason, yeah, I might be qualified, but I'm not prepared to answer those questions, because purposely Blackheart's avoided those questions because I wanted to focus on where the soldiers' heads were at. And the soldiers' heads at that time, in that place, when they're in a combat zone, they couldn't care less about the geopolitical ramifications of what they're doing. What they care about is whether or not they're going to make it till tomorrow and if there's going to be hot food for dinner.
Let me ask you, though, one of the very first points of the caller made, it was a reference to the fact that that the military has really struggled to get enough people to have enough boots on the ground. And I think that we have all heard, we've even discussed on this program, the question of whether or not the military has had to lower its standards in order to meet its recruiting targets. So then I suppose we do come to the question, and I wonder, based on whatever kind of conversations you've had with people in the military, whether they're thinking about this, whether this tragedy could have been avoided, should have been avoided, but it wasn't, because there was such a demand for people that you pretty much had to take almost anybody who was willing to go and would at least meet some minimum standard.
Well, I think that's unquestionably true. I think it's darn near a fact, if it's not actually a fact, that the Army has lowered its standards in order to be able to maintain its recruitment quotas and be able to field armies that can fight an army that can fight two wars simultaneously. I mean, I think that's a foregone conclusion. The pressure might have lessened a little bit during the financial crisis, where I did see some stories that the financial crisis was actually encouraging more people to join the Army than had when the Iraq War was at its most dangerous and soldiers were dying in factors of 100, you know, increments of 100 every month. So those pressures might have been alleviated slightly. And, you know, we can fault the Army for its obvious and systemic failures to root out people like Stephen Green. On the other hand, I think that some of the blame has to fall back on the American people and the American government, because we, as the American people, have made it abundantly clear that we are perfectly fine with having this country be at war for 9 years straight. But the thought that there would be a draft or anything other than an all-volunteer army is people wouldn't even discuss it. I mean, it's a political non-starter. So we want, or if we don't want, we are okay with our country being at war for almost a decade straight. But to say that it's entirely the Army's fault for scraping the bottom of the barrel when most Americans would adamantly refuse to send their own sons and daughters to that army, I think, you know, the blame can be spread to the Army, but looking at the broader issue, it's we all want something for nothing, or we're acceptable, even if we're anti-war and we say that these wars are a mistake, we're not willing to say that they're a mistake enough to get them to stop, or certainly to institute a draft. So, you know, I have a certain sympathy with the Army recruiter here, you know, who's trying to make his quota, who's trying to fill the ranks for wars that we seem to be okay to wage continuously.
Our guest, again, let me introduce, is Jim Frederick. He's contributing editor at Time Magazine. His book is Black Hearts, One Platoon's Descent into Madness in Iraq's Triangle of Death, published by Harmony Books, an effort to explain, at least try to get a better understanding of one of what was certainly one of the worst war crimes of the Iraq War. This was in 2006, when a small group of U.S. soldiers raped and murdered an Iraqi girl, 14-year-old girl, and also shot several members of her family. They all were charged with this crime, were found guilty, and are serving long sentences. One of them was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Questions certainly I welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure in the effort to explain this, or at least to get a better understanding, you look at a couple of levels. We've talked about these men, their own something of who they were, what their experiences were that they were going through. But you also have to look at the leadership. And I think that as much as this being a personal failure on that their parts, this certainly was a failure of leadership, really. And I think going all the way at least up into the colonel, the lieutenant colonel that was the top guy. And I must admit, I get confused about the military technology when you talk about the different groupings, you know, but the person who was essentially the top commanding officer of this group of men.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you could make a pretty persuasive case that there was a failure of leadership at pretty much every rank level and every unit organizational level, and sometimes several failures. The book, I hope, makes a pretty factual case for that. And so, yeah, I mean, you would have a squad and platoon, company, battalion, and even a brigade level. Although, like we talked about earlier, the book specifically doesn't address it by name, but I think that the failures, the leadership failures, go all the way, you know, to the brigade, to the division, and beyond to the commander-in-chief at that time, because it was a failed strategy. And so, you know, leadership reaches all the way up, in fact. But, yeah, I think that the book makes a fairly persuasive case that there were repeated and systemic leadership failures in this unit.
What about it maybe talking about at the more immediate level, that is, the people who were, say, the non-commissioned officers, the people that were, and maybe the officers who were just, who would have been just right above these four guys?
Well, yeah. If you look at what happened during the time of the rape murder, that squad leader was on leave. That platoon's platoon leader, who is a lieutenant, was on leave. Right there, they didn't have the oversight that was needed and was necessary. This particular platoon, however, had been really gutted by battlefield losses. They had lost their original platoon leader, who was a beloved and, by all accounts, a very good leader, who got blown up by an IED in December. They lost a squad leader a couple of weeks before that. They lost a team leader, which is in charge of half of a squad. They lost a rifleman, and in addition to that, they had a platoon sergeant, and the platoon sergeant is really supposed to be probably the most immediate parental figure, is probably a bad phrase, but the most immediate oversight figure. This platoon had, in a space of less than 45 days, had three platoon sergeants, which is a platoon sergeant, unless the platoon sergeant is killed, is really supposed to see you through the entire deployment. And platoon sergeants will very often keep the same platoon for years on end. So whether it's a failure, meaning the personal leader didn't do a good job, or the fact that it was a leadership failure that they got killed or rotated out, or
the battalion command structure was trying to find the right platoon sergeant, and so they rotated through several guys in quick succession, which was pretty alienating for that platoon, which was already combat hardened, and so they had these new guys coming in. And, you know, like a foreign body, they almost expelled the platoon sergeant who's supposed to be the boss. And so then you get into very complicated platoon political dynamics about if you don't have enough combat credibility, you're going to have a very tough time leading troops that have already seen a lot of combat. And, you know, there's entire Vietnam War movies that are predicated upon this entire concept, but that concept is very true, and it holds true even in Iraq, and especially when a unit had seen this much combat. So a platoon sergeant who comes in doesn't have a lot of combat credibility and struggles to establish that credibility, and in the meantime, the platoon isn't being particularly well led.
Yeah. And just to make things that much worse, and perhaps this is also a symptom of combat stress and people's attempts to try to deal with it, there was a very high level of substance abuse going on. How does that happen?
Well, it happens very easily because, you know, contrary to many of the media perceptions, Iraq itself is not this teetotaler culture. It is not a puritanical culture. Iraqi men love a good drink and a good smoke. And so Iraqi men, I'm generalizing, of course there are some that are puritanical or fundamentalist, but in general, you know, I've met many Iraqi men who like to bond over a stiff drink or several stiff drinks. And so this unit was working side by side with an Iraqi army unit at the time, and the Iraqi army guys all had booze. And so if you want a bottle of whiskey for $5, an Iraqi soldier is more than happy to sell you his whiskey. So getting liquor in this Muslim supposedly fundamentalist puritanical society is not a problem. Anybody who wants to get some booze can get some booze. That is not the issue. How widespread it was is an open question. One of my priorities of the book was not necessarily to call out, especially by name, soldiers who were drinking. I mean, it just really wasn't what I was after. But it does seem to be fairly widespread, especially among the lower ranks. I mean, I'm not really looking to get them in trouble after the fact, but you know, it was fairly common. And drinking happened, especially towards the middle, darkest period of the deployments, I think it's fair to say. I mean, some never did, you know, and I have to pay respect to the first platoon members who will say, you know, I never did that, and that's fine. And I'm not on a mission to find out who did and who didn't. But, you know, among many of the others, they will say, you know, fairly, you know, without a lot of prompting, that it was pretty common that soldiers every other day, sometimes more frequently than that, would have a drink or more to take the edge off and the extreme combat stress that they were feeling. It doesn't make it okay, and it's, in fact, quite dangerous. But it was fairly widespread, and among the upper echelons, meaning platoon sergeant, platoon leader, and on up, and I'm talking exclusively here about 1st Platoon. Yeah, I mean, that itself is a failure if the leaders of a particular unit don't know that drinking and even using certain kind of pills is fairly widespread. Well, that right there means that you've got an oversight problem.
How we're coming down to maybe about 5-6 minutes. One thing I want to make sure that we talk about is how it is that this crime actually came to light.
Right. Well, the four men who committed the crime on March 12, 2006. They were able to get away with it because they were at a remote checkpoint where they were a mile away at least from any other American Army presence. There were 6 men there. No soldier there was over the rank of specialist, which is not even an NCO rank. That's how thinly staffed they were. The four of the six decided to commit this crime. They left the perimeter of this checkpoint completely undetected. Only one of the 2 soldiers that was left behind was even aware that they were going, and they basically just told this private that, you know, we're leaving and we're coming back in 10 minutes. They went 200 or 300 meters away. They committed this horrific crime. They were back within 15 minutes, and nobody was the wiser. The private who knew about it was either sufficiently, you know, scared or threatened enough to keep quiet about it, and they would have gotten away with it. Nobody was any the wiser. And because Iraqi and Iraqi violence in this region was so widespread, it was absolutely 100% plausible that when people were called back to the crime scene to investigate it, the theory that this was insurgent work or this was some sort of partisan religious grudge match that was coming to roost, or, you know, it was just a family feud gone wrong, was a completely plausible theory. It was absolutely 100% believable because this unit was picking up dead Iraqi bodies almost literally every day. That's how dire the civil war among the Iraqis themselves was in this place at that time. So that was March, and these men, they would have gotten away with it, but everybody tells somebody. And Stephen Green actually told another soldier pretty much that night, although this other soldier didn't really believe him, did a little investigation, convinced himself that Green was telling the truth, and rather than turn Green in, he pretty much ordered him to get out of the army. You know, you're such a dirtbag, I don't ever want to see you again, but you need to get out of this army. And that's a completely different story about how one does that. Green was already known to be mentally unstable or getting more unstable all the time, so he was actually chaptered out of the army on a mental health chapter not long after that. So he did actually get himself out of the army without anybody being any the wiser about the crime. Anyway, this soldier that had originally confessed to Stephen Green told another soldier a couple of weeks, if not months later, that, you know, in the aftermath of the other checkpoint being overrun, that I can't believe all the good men die and the murderers are back home eating hamburgers, is either what he said or something close to that. I mean, that was the quote that the soldier who wound up confessing or coming forward remembered afterwards, that the soldier had told him. And he said, "Murderers, what are you talking about?" And the soldier that Green had told him the whole story of what Green said had happened at the checkpoint. And so while the soldier who was originally confessed to didn't feel the need to turn the other soldiers in, the soldier who now had third-hand knowledge, he walked it back and forth. He remembered that day. It seemed plausible to him, and he just couldn't live with it anymore. And so he decided that he needed to come forward and basically rat out his friends because he believed that it was – he didn't have any firsthand knowledge, but he believed it to be true. And so he told another sergeant who told the platoon sergeant, and the platoon sergeant and the platoon leader, to their great credit, took it seriously from word go. The second they heard about it, they said, well, you know, we're going to have to investigate it. And so they pushed it up the chain, and within less than 24 hours, the Army was very seriously investigating these allegations, and it all came out.
You've had the opportunity to talk with two of the four men who were charged and found guilty, James Barker and Stephen Green. Barker, I think, actually admitted to this and accepted responsibility. Green was the guy, I think, who got the most serious sentence. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. And I don't know if he has expressed any sort of remorse about this or accepted any kind of responsibility. What was your experience as actually meeting them and talking with them, and did you feel that you had some sense of who they were?
Oh, that's a great question. I spoke with both of them for several hours each, and it was very disturbing and dismaying conversations. I will say that both men did have remorse. I'm not sure that they had the degree of remorse that most people would have. On the other hand, obviously, most people would not have committed such crimes. Stephen Green did, in fact, give a public statement of remorse during his sentencing hearing when relatives of the Janabi family, whom he murdered, were in the gallery of that courtroom during the sentencing. And he did give a very heartfelt-sounding expression of remorse for the crimes that he committed. But those were difficult conversations, and they were uneasy conversations. And on the one hand, you know, they were men like any other men. On the other hand, you could see quite clearly that they were very unlike most men. But given that I only had a couple of hours with each of them to try to understand truly unfathomable crimes, but the whole book was trying to explain the unexplainable, I wouldn't say that I really was able to see into their souls or know what they
how they ticked. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, expressions of remorse, only they know whether that how genuine their expressions of remorse are. I mean, they certainly express remorse, but I couldn't say whether or not their expressions of remorse are heartfelt to the point, you know, deep within their souls that they believe it to be true. I just don't know.
Yeah. Maybe we have about a minute or so left. Earlier in our conversation, you talked about the fact that within the military command structure, people are actually reading this book and passing it around and saying to one another and to people who are commanders or would-be commanders, look, this is something that you really ought to know about. Having said that, do you think that the military command at high levels has learned something from this experience and anything else like it, and that anything changed as a result?
Well, I think that the way that the unit was operating, first platoon, and the way that they were so stretched out and they were so thinned out and doing these patrols where they only had three or four men, I mean, that was so far beyond the bounds of how the Army should be operating in the first place. It's not like they went to best practices or they went to their doctrine and they revised their doctrine. I think the thing that's most shocking to people in senior command positions is that this unit was operating in that way in the first place. So if an individual platoon leader or company commander or battalion commander who reads the book and upon reading the book resolves that the dual tensions of the Army, which is, you know, you have to go by the rules, but you also have to get the mission done. This unit seemed a lot of times to be under tremendous pressure to get the mission done, rules be damned. You know, maybe there would be a second thought that, well, you know, there's a reason that the rules that, you know, you have to travel in a three Humvee convoy exist for a reason. It's just safer that way. It's not just safer for American troops. Well, look what these guys did. It's actually safer for the local population, too, because then with oversight, it doesn't allow rogue soldiers to actually go rogue. Mm. So, maybe in a case-by-case, leader-by-leader factor, it would make a change, but there were so many rules being broken that I don't actually think that it's incumbent upon the Army to overhaul their entire system. What is incumbent is make sure that the doctrines are in place or actually followed, because the doctrines exist for a reason and are time-tested.
We will have to leave it at that. Our guest, Jim Frederick, is contributing editor at Time magazine. The book is Black Hearts, One Platoon's Descent into Madness in Iraq's Triangle of Death, published by Harmony Books. Mr. Frederick, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.